Peter, hello, how are you going?
Hey, Josh.
Some interesting stuff in this poll, the first one back for 2026, Happy New Year and everything. It feels weird to say that at the end of January, but run us through quickly off the top. Where is the primary vote at? What are the parties doing? Where are Australians thinking about to put their vote at the start of 2026 after all the traumatic sort of summer that we've had?
Well, Josh, much like the coalition, we are in a state of flux and chaos right now because we predicate our polling on there being two stable mainstream parties that we can anchor a two-party preferred vote around. For regular listeners, I might not need to explain this, but 2PP, we basically reduce people's vote to their how it would play out if it was a two-horse race in a particular seat and then around the nation. And so we try to attribute preferences based on the flow of the previous election. Our problem right now is that we no longer have a coalition as the second party. We now have One Nation polling at 22% as the second largest party in our sample, followed by a mixture of different groups previously known as the coalition, including the Liberal Party, which is at about 19%, the National Party at 4%, and the LNP, which is the weirdest of them all, a merged party within a demerged coalition with 4% in Queensland. So for the first time in, I think, the almost 20 years of the Essential Report, we cannot give you a 2PP this time around because it just, we've been beautifully minding this, trying to make it work, but it is just in a state of flux. Maybe the party room gets back together for the interest of pollsters, if no one else. But at the moment, all we can say is that there is a very strange thing going on in Australian politics that could change the way we do things in the long term.
So what are those couple of top numbers there? I mean, run us through where Labor's at. Yeah. Like you said, the coalition no longer exists at the time of recording. But, you know, Labor, Liberal, National, One Nation, Greens, where are the various parties at?
So Labor's at 31 primary, which is down 3 from the election. We've got the coalition, as I said, all over the place. One Nation, which I think polled between 6 and 8 at the last election, is now polling with us on 21, and that includes adding in the don't knows. Mm. Actually, it's 22. So it's been a seismic shift. And it's happened really quickly. Well, it's happened slowly, slowly, then very quickly, a bit like how people go broke. That's what's happened with the coalition, but it's moving very fast at the moment.
Is this outside of Liberal National Coalition Labor, is this the highest there's ever been a third party vote in the Essential poll? I'm putting you on a spot here.
I don't think the Greens ever got higher than high teens. Like I'd say yes. You know, obviously we're at a point in a cycle where you can get the signal and the noise mixed up. I would not read these as intentions to vote because there is not a vote for 2.5 years.
Yes.
I think this is more a vote of no confidence, particularly in the coalition. And let me unpack that a little bit. If you look at where are the votes coming from, 23% of people who voted for the coalition in 2025 say they are now inclined to vote for One Nation, a quarter of the vote. 8% of people who voted Labor also say they would now vote One Nation. So it's not purely a coalition phenomenon, but it's 3-1, the damage is being done to the coalition. Of the One Nation vote, because it's almost double, just 47% are returning One Nation voters, 31% former coalition voters, 12% former Labor voters. So, like I say, it's not at this stage a signifier of intent, but I think it's also not trivial that this many people are looking at the performance, particularly of the coalition, but also to a lesser extent of the Labor government, and saying that of all the alternatives and places they want to go, it's not to the Teals, it's not to the Greens, it's to Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce. Mm. And the One Nation brand, which has been pilloried for 30 years, you know, it's a bit like the deplorables with MAGA and the Trumps. It's a bit like the Farage group in Britain. If there is a vote of no confidence in the system, these populist right-wing parties who are fueled by the noise and the anger and the energy of the media, particularly in times of intense conflict, which is what we have experienced over the summer, particularly with the hurt and anger and the confected noise in some quarters that occurred around the Bondi shootings, yep. the massacre there, has created a febrile environment which on these numbers, the major parties are struggling yep. to resonate with.
And we will pull apart some of the stuff specifically about Bondi in a second, because there are some really interesting points to be made there about, you know, most people seem to be very on board with the measures that the government and governments have taken in response to Bondi, but that hasn't necessarily translated into support for Albanese or Susan Lee. But to stay with One Nation just very quickly before we move on to that, as you said a second ago, One Nation at 22, it doesn't mean everything because, as you say, you know, we're still quite a while away from the next election. You know, we're not in campaign mode yet. People might park their vote, so the, you know, inverted commas, protest vote for the time being, and then sort of towards the election, they might go, oh, actually, you know, I do want to vote for Susan Lee or the Coalition or Albo or the Greens or whoever. People might change their mind at the end. But it's also not nothing either, because for me personally, I think this will be one of the most fascinating stories of the next couple of years, is how One Nation, which has traditionally been quite disorganized, it's been a personality party of Pauline Hanson. Whenever someone moves over there, think of Mark Latham, think of other, you know, people that have joined One Nation. People have moved over there, high profile defections, and then they've had a big bust up with Pauline Hanson and it's all fallen apart. I think it'll be fascinating to see how One Nation, if and how they hold it together over the next couple of years, because at this stage they're polling 22% and they haven't really got any policies. It's not like people are going, wow, Pauline's got such a great idea on tax or the economy or on, you know, development or on housing. Or people know Pauline Hanson and One Nation as, you know, they're going to shut the borders and they're going to crack down on immigrants and all this sort of stuff. I mean, you know, journalists, I think, are sort of making some poor performances in interviewing Pauline Hanson and other people in One Nation recently, going, oh, Pauline, wouldn't you like to be Prime Minister one day? And I mean, it's One Nation's currently got one seat in the lower house. It's Barnaby Joyce, who was elected to the Nat. They've got a couple in the Senate. They've never actually won a House of Representatives seat off their own bat previously. Pauline Hanson obviously being elected as a Liberal, under a Liberal banner in 1996. But Peter, talking about this, right, One Nation has 22% nationally. Is it likely that in certain pockets of Australia they've got a much higher vote, say in Nationals heartland, in parts of Queensland, where they are going to challenge for a lower house seat?
Yeah, I think we've got in regional cities it's like 30%, which is interesting. It's not pure regional. It's not rural, it's regional. Look, it's a protest. One Nation is not a party the way that traditional political parties operate, any more than the network of independents that have taken the seats from the city Liberals up. What they are is a rallying cry, an opportunity to run a politics of protest that can be, up until now, not mediated by the need to implement policy. And as we've seen in other jurisdictions, once you get in, like, it can get pretty crazy pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, immigration, anti-renewables, and one of the problems for a coalition that is still trying to find where it goes, and you saw over January, there will not be a position that is knee-jerk, either anti-Muslim, that will not be hard enough for One Nation to trump on the right flank. But at the same time, One Nation has also got the economic nationalism, the sense that the system's letting us down. And that's the thing that has really driven, you know, it's the two things hand in hand. So to defend high immigration, the government and the opposition defend a system of, you know, capitalism, if you want to call it, that it doesn't deliver equitably.
Yep.
You know, it's easy to trivialise One Nation as the protest, but there is something going on and it's going on around the world, and progressive left of centre parties need to confront it, because once you're in power, you get deeply embedded in power. Yeah. And if the exercise of that power is not delivering for those people, they will go somewhere else. And that's what's happening in the States, what's happening in the UK. And while it's hitting the coalition now, it would be naive to think that this sort of challenge on the populist right is not something that could also cause grief for Labor in the longer term.
And just today, obviously, we got some data showing inflation on the way up again in the last period. Peter, to go to Bondi, you asked some really interesting questions in the Essential report this time around about people's support for the government's responses to anti-Semitism on national security and so forth in that emergency session of Parliament last week. Run us through some of these numbers, because there was quite widespread support for a couple of them. I'm looking here at, you know, banning display of terrorist symbols, 73% of people backed that, 63% backed strengthening gun laws, 56% backed a royal commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion. So more than half, or far more than half, backed some of these measures, but that didn't translate at all into people's support for Anthony Albanese's handling of that tragedy, because a lot of people thought that he didn't handle that very well at all.
Correct. So 56 not well, or not well at all, for Albanese's handling, just 36% saying he handled it well, notwithstanding that the measures the government, but I think this is a mixture of federal and some of the stuff in New South Wales.
Correct, yeah.
Majority support, single digit opposition, almost across the board. And I think this is one of the ways through. Like in my column today, I say that while Albanese has been personally wounded over January, he's also perversely in a really strong position to lead Australia through it. And no one's going to remember that he pushed back on the Royal Commission. Once the Royal Commission's on, they support the Royal Commission. You know, criminalising hate speech, which used to be what we lefties called racial vilification, had been something that the right had pushed off against for ages. It's just bizarre that that's now become the issue that split the coalition. Also interesting to note that when we ask people their views on hate laws, the coalition view, or the libertarian right view, that hate speech laws are an unacceptable curb on free speech, only have very limited support, 22% overall. Majority of people want to see if hate speech laws extend to all religions and other groups like LGBTI and people with disability. So it's kind of like a classic own goal in the heat of the noise, which, you know, and let's put our minds back 4 weeks. It was like, it was all consuming. To be fair to the Prime Minister, he fronted up on some of those days where he was the flashpoint for the anger and the hurt and, you know, the totally outrageous interventions of the Netanyahu blaming Australia's recognition of Palestine for the attacks, the performance of Frydenberg, Lee's refusal to show any semblance of leadership and trying to politicise it from the moment. So it did hurt him, but it also has left him as the last man standing in a way to lead Australia back. But the other thing I did want to point, because we tested a few messages here, which I think one of the other challenges things of Bondi, if we think over summer, particularly those of us who may have marched on the bridge against the genocide in Gaza, we asked people whether they agree or disagree, is it possible to be critical of the Israeli government and also oppose anti-Semitism? And the majority of people agree with that. And again, that sense, it doesn't need to be a binary position. So that said, there is also a significant number of people who have bought some of the arguments. So 38% of people say that Australia's decision to recognise Palestine contributed to the attacks, 38% agree, 37% not sure, 24% reject. So it's not like these issues have been resolved because of what happened at Bondi. And so the need for leadership that holds the nation together, I think, is really critical now. And this is where, despite it being a really challenging month for the PM, despite the hit he's personally taken in the polls and the drop in Labor's primary vote, it feels like the way through is very aligned with the way that the Jewish community in Bondi process their grief, particularly the rabbis calling for mitzvah, which is very similar, if you unpack it, to Albanese's embrace of a notion of the politics of kindness, which sounds really mawkish when you just sort of throw it out there. But in it was a different approach he took. So you had one side of politics trying to up the temperature and the outrage and attribute blame. And you had the Prime Minister turning up and taking the anger. Like, I think if there's criticism of the PM, it was what happened before then, when he didn't really confront that difference between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel and allowed anti-Semitism to build its own energy as a way of stifling critical thought about the Israeli government. And I think it's been interesting to watch the way different communities since then have sought something better than that, right? And that, that can live with that complexity. So I do think there is an opportunity with that notion of a politics of kindness for the Prime Minister to lead himself through what has been a really difficult period.
And I think that point that you make there, and like, you know, I worked over the summer and here at the sort of height of the political fallout of Bondi, and, you know, the opposition leader and the opposition are incredibly upset and incredibly mad that the Prime Minister wasn't, you know, out there at the Bondi scene every day. You know, Susan Lee was there every day, and she made a point of saying she was there every day and, you know, meeting with families and that sort of thing. And Albanese, for a short period there, that's sort of obviously been forgotten in the crush now, with everything else happening politics wise, there was that period where he was under a fair bit of pressure to, you know, show more empathy for the community and to turn up, and, you know, why hadn't he turned up for, you know, since the first day and all those sort of things. He obviously went to the memorial service and was booed by some in the crowd, and all the while there back in Canberra and working on the legislative response that, you know, we've talked about here, the hate speech laws and the gun laws and that sort of thing. At that time, it was like the biggest political story, you know. Now, it sort of has faded away a little bit. I think, you know, I do wonder in some communities how that will be remembered, and, you know, if the Prime Minister will be marked down for that for some time to come. But at the same time, while we had Susan Lee, you know, saying that the Albanese hasn't done enough and he's doing the wrong thing and all this sort of stuff, her approval rating has also ticked down quite substantially between December and January as well. What do you think that shows?
Yeah, correct.
What do you make of that? Those numbers going down too.
Look, I just think that there was no subtlety in her approach. So her disapproval's gone up to 47 from 43. Her approvals have dropped 4 points. So she's had net 8 deterioration in her position. And she was doing a lot of things over those weeks that took up a lot of oxygen and got boosted very uncritically by sections of the media. And I know we're talking code there, but none of what she was doing was leading. And I just think these numbers reflect that being noisy and getting the first grab and confecting an indignation and attacking your opponent, it was the most significant terror attack this country's ever seen, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I know there's been Port Arthur and things, but like an ideologically driven shooting into a crowd of kids, you know, over their religion, right? And I think the noise at the center was so vociferous that it was easy to get dragged into that. But then people looking at it did not see that as leading, and it was such a failure. It would have been a lot harder, obviously, for her to stand beside Albo. But, you know, the New South Wales politicians managed to find a way of doing it, and they've both come out of it with their reputations enhanced. So the fact that, yes, she managed to drag a few points off Albanese, but she also tanked her own numbers. She's broken up the coalition. She's forced the government to basically put her in a position where she wedges herself on a matter of ideological principle for her right flank that's keeping her in power at the moment. And then she wonders why the coalition has imploded. Like, sometimes when big events occur, you don't know where the ramifications are gonna land. And I think this is, you know, things have moved very, very quickly here. And, you know, and maybe Colin Boyce will be the next leader of the National Party, but, you know.
Let's quickly whip through two last ones before we have to finish up, because time is against us as always. And one question that really stood out to me, you asked people what was the closest to their point of view. 35% of people said that hate laws should extend to all religions and other groups like LGBTI and disability, which is an avenue that the government has said they're open to exploring. Who knows what will happen there. 32% said hate speech laws should apply to all religions. 22% hate speech laws are an unacceptable curb on free speech. And 10% said hate speech laws should only apply to radical Muslim preachers. I mean, 35% saying one thing, 32% saying another thing, and then, you know, 22 plus 10 sort of saying, you know, concerns about who it should apply to and that sort of thing. Pretty evenly split, you know, almost a third between those couple of broad categories there. What do you think that says about what the government might end up doing next?
Issues that poll a third are always what are known as wicked political problems, because there's no natural majority. So, look, criminalising speech is a big call. right? In a liberal democracy like ours, we've got our defamation laws, we've got certain other, like, assault, those sorts of laws. But criminalizing speech is a big call. But in the wake of this inexplicable attack, people are up for it. So it's really interesting to think about how that can be developed in a consistent, fair way that still allows for us to be a society that competes with ideas. And I think the libertarians who don't want any constraints are then matched by, there's always been the issue around religion that you want to have the right, you know, it was a big thing sort of even during sort of gay marriage discussions and things, like the right to sort of worship even though it might offend somebody else. And so the definitions are going to be really important. But I feel like this is where the leadership you need is not to have the fight, but to work through the complexity. I suspect that's where Albanese plays his best game. It's where you've got the proposition, then you've got to negotiate it through with the other stakeholders in the parliament. And where it lands, I don't think you're going to have a Muslim-specific set of laws. There may be some sort of religious laws, but I think it's also going to be very much at the extremes. But, you know, the Overton window's open for this, and so there is a fair bit of momentum to do something. I'd also note the government's been sitting on the report of the Human Rights Commission's National Racism Strategy for about the last 9 months, and there are recommendations in there that could also help inform this and take it out from being a Bondi-specific set of laws to one that's more talking about, so what is the sort of society we want to have?
Josh Butler and Peter Lewis will be right back.